Okay, I want to cover as many topics from the Sedra that we can. Let's start with the name of the book. The name of this Sefer is Sefer Shmos, but there's another name for the Sefer, as all the Sfarim in the Torah have two names. They have the name that's taken from the first few words of the book, and in addition there is a thematic name that Chazal gave each Sefer. Sefer Bereishis is called Sefer HaYetzira. Sefer Shmos is called Sefer HaGeula. Sefer Vayikra is called Mishneh Torah, is called Toras Kohanim. Bamidbar is called Chumash HaPikudim. And Devarim is Mishneh Torah. Now, even if you haven't heard those names before, you have heard those names before, except you didn't know it. Because every time you refer to the names of the Chumash in the Greek, that is exactly the name they took, the Chazal name, the thematic name, and translated into Greek, and that's the name they use for the Sfarim. For instance, Sefer Bereishis, which is Sefer HaYetzira, in Greek is Genesis, which means the book of creation. Exodus is the book of redemption, Exodus from Egypt. Leviticus is the laws of the tribe of Levi, which is Toras Kohanim. Numbers, if you ever wondered why Bamidbar is called Numbers, it's because it's Chumash HaPikudim. Chumash HaPikudim means it is the book that deals with the counting, with the census of Klal Yisrael. When they came into the Midbar, there was one census. When they left the Midbar, there was another census. And the whole book of Bamidbar is sandwiched between the census in Parshas Bamidbar and the census in Parshas Pinchas. So it is Chumash HaPikudim, Numbers. And Deuteronomy means the review of the law, which is Mishneh Torah. So the Greek names of the Sfarim are the thematic names that Chazal gave the Sfarim. Now, each of the names parallels, they go together very nicely, except for one book. Bereishis, in the beginning, fits very nicely with Sefer HaYetzira. Vayikra, the Rabban Hashem called to Moshe from Oel Moed. What was the purpose? To teach him the laws of Karbanos and the Kohanim. So Toras Kohanim and Vayikra have a tremendous connection. Bamidbar, whatever happened in the Midbar happened between the two sensei, I guess that's the way you say it. And therefore, it's Chumash HaPikudim. It's the book of the countings. And it's also Bamidbar, what happened in the Midbar between those two times. And Devarim, Eila HaDvarim Asher Dibrei Moshe, what were the Devarim? Mishneh Torah. Fit very nicely. The only one that doesn't fit is Shmos. What in the world does Shmos, names, have to do with Sefer HaGeula? Why is the book of Geula called Names? That's the question. To answer the question, say the following. There is a medrash that says, "Bizchus ve'ela shmos b'nei Yisrael, miskaimin ve'ela toldo shomayim va'aretz." In the merit of the names of the Jewish people, the world exists. Also, very strange. What in the world can the world exist because of names? Because the names of Klal Yisrael? The Rashi in the beginning of Shmos brings down that Klal Yisrael are like the stars. Just like the Rabban Hashem counts every star and calls each one by a name, so too he counts the Jewish people and calls each one by name. Alive in Parshas Ve'ela Shmos B'nei Yisrael, and then it lists them, each of the Shvatim by name, and also the Elish Mos B'nei Yisrael, just like it says by the Kochavim, Mone Mispar La Kochavim, Likulam B'Shem Mos Yikra, the Rabban Hashem counts the stars and calls each one by name, so too the Rabban Hashem Olam counts the Jewish people and calls each one by name. So what does that mean? Every star has a name, big deal. And therefore the Jews are just like stars, we also have names, and God counts us. I'll tell you, I was just in the States with this It was in the States usually around this time of year, almost every year. And from about 25 years ago till today, I've heard every time I'm there the same advertisement on the radio. It used to be in America, today maybe it's not like that anymore, but it used to be that there were people in America who had everything. And therefore, in this gift-giving time of year for the non-Jews, it's very hard to find a present to give somebody who has everything. So they advertised that in case you have somebody on your gift list that has everything and you are breaking your head to find a gift to give them, we have the following idea. If you will send, 25 years ago it was $25, then about 2-3 years ago it was up to $75, and this year it was $54. I guess they had a bad year. In any case, if you send a certain amount of money to the following address, they will name a star for the person that you want to give the gift. They will register it in the star registry. This year they added something. I'm sure they had a court case about it. They added that the star registry will be registered in the Library of Congress in book form. And they will send an affidavit to the person that you sent the money for, that the star with such and such coordinates is named for him. Okay. Don't send any money. I'll tell you, if you really want a star named for you, you can go out tonight, name every star in the sky for yourself, your family, anybody else that you want. You can record it in your own star registry. Take out a piece of paper, write on top of it, star registry. And you can, if you want, register that in book form in the Library of Congress, pretty much for a small fee. You can register anything in the Library of Congress in book form. Okay? So that's exactly what they do. It has no official bearing. That star is named for you in their little book. So you can name it for you in your little book, and you don't have to pay any money. You can name every star for free. So that's what it means. God calls the stars by names. Every star has a name. Big deal. What does it mean? In addition, there's another medrash in the beginning of this week's Sedra that says that the Geula is hinted to in the names of B'nai Yisrael. So what does that mean? What does it mean that the Geula is hinted to in the names of Klal Yisrael? A name represents the essence of the thing that it describes, not just an arbitrary thing. In Hebrew, the name of anything, it says Adam HaRishon, called names to everything in the Bria, including himself and the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it was a tremendous chachma that he had. He didn't just arbitrarily pick names. But the name in Lashon HaKodesh represents the abilities, capabilities, talents, qualities of the thing that it is named for, that it names, that it identifies. And it's not just the meaning of the word, even though that's also included. For instance, a kelev. One of the reasons it's called a kelev, because it has one heart for its master. It's a very loyal animal. So kelev has the word lev in it. Lev echad. But it's more than that. The letters of the word kelev are manifestations of spiritual powers that in this world appear as letters. But they are spiritual powers in a spiritual world. Those powers, chaf, lamed beis, are the powers that go into a dog. They're the spiritual counterpart of what a dog is. The gematria of kelev has a significance. It's everything about that word represents the talents, abilities, capabilities of that bria. The name of a human being also represents his or her talents, abilities, capabilities, qualities, essence. And again, it's not just the simple meaning of the name. It goes much deeper than that. And that's why, since the name has a connection to all these spiritual powers, it's like a wiring that wires the person. It connects them to their spiritual sources. We don't change names so quickly because you could cause short circuits. So we don't, Bizman HaZeh, we don't change people's names. Just the opposite. Changing a person's name could change their whole din. It's one of the things that could avert a bad din on a person. People who got sick, they used to change their name completely. We don't change your name. We just add a name. But we don't change the name. So names, in Lashon HaKodesh especially, represent the essence, the abilities, the capabilities and talents of the person. In that respect, Chazal say that every person has four names. The name Hashem gives you, the name your parents give you, the name your friends give you, and the main name is the one you make for yourself. In my estimation, what that means is the following. The name, like we said, represents the talents, abilities, capabilities that you have. Some of those talents, abilities, and capabilities are given to you directly by the Ribbono Shel Olam. When our neshamas were created, every neshama has a different quality, different aspects to it, different abilities, capabilities, and talents. And that is your name that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you directly. Every neshama has a part to play in the eternal, universal world plan of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And therefore, it's different, and it has its own unique qualities. That's the name that God gives you. There are certain talents, abilities, and capabilities that you don't get because of the creation of your neshama, but indirectly, the Ribbono Shel Olam gives it to you through heredity. If your parents were musically inclined, maybe you'll be musically inclined. Parents had black hair, you may have black hair, and so on. So there's heredity that is the cause of many of the talents, abilities, and capabilities and qualities that a person has. That's the name your parents give you. Then there are things that you learn from your environment, from your friends. That's the name your friends give you. And finally, all of that is potential. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you, what your parents gave you, what your friends give you. The main name is what you make for yourself. How you realize that potential. Because potential is like a big zero. If you have a lot of potential, you have a lot of zeros, still zero. If you put a number before those zeros, it turns it into a tremendously big number if you have more zeros. But if you have nothing in front of it, 10 zeros is the same thing as 1 zero. So potential is not the main thing. The main thing is how much of that potential you realize. What you put in front of that potential, what name you make for yourself. That's the name you make for yourself. That's, in my estimation, what Chazal mean, that the four names of a person is the talents, abilities, capabilities, and their sources, the Ribbono Shel Olam, your parents, your friends, yourself, in realizing it all. In any case, the Geula, what's Geula? Geula is redeeming something that is suppressed, redeeming that which is potential but doesn't have a chance to express itself. That's called shibud, something that's suppressed, something that's in bondage. Person has tremendous potential but he can't release it, so his potential is basically enslaved within him. Releasing that potential is geula. And therefore, the geula in the world is when the world will reach its full potential, its perfection. How does the world reach its full protection, its full perfection? By each individual reaching their perfection. There's a beautiful story that illustrates that. This is not a chazal. It's not a medrash, it's not a chazal. I heard it at a graduation once. There was a man reading a magazine, and his little 5-year-old was bothering him incessantly, and he couldn't make headway in the magazine. So he called over his little 5-year-old daughter, and he said, I have a page here of the magazine that's a map of the world. And he tore it into 20 pieces, and he gave it to her, and he said, this is a map of the world, it's a puzzle. Go put it together, and don't come back till you finish. So he figured, the girl's only 5, she has no idea what the picture of the map of the world looks like. The only way she can put it together is by matching the contours of the tears. It's going to take her hours. So he figured he has a few hours now of peace and quiet. The girl's going to keep busy. 15 minutes later, she comes back and she says, I finished. The map is reconstructed perfectly. He says, impossible. The only way you could have done it in 15 minutes is if you knew what the map of the world looks like, and you don't know what the map of the world looks like, so it's impossible. He said, come and, she said, come and look. Goes to look, and there on the glass top of a coffee table, the map of the world is put together 100% properly. The guy says, you're a genius. I never knew it. You're 5 years old. You must have known what the map of the world looks like, and that's how you put it together. She said, no, it was real easy. You see, on the other side of the page, there was a picture of a man. I just put the man together, and the whole world fell into place. If you want to perfect the world, start by perfecting yourself. So when a person is able to bring out his potential and make himself perfect and redeem himself, redeem his qualities, that will lead to the redemption of the world. And therefore, the Geula is hinted to in the names of Bnei Yisrael. And it's in the schus of the names of Bnei Yisrael that the world exists. Meaning the talents, abilities, capabilities, the potential that each and every one of us have is the purpose for creation. And the perfection of the world is hinted to and lies in those names. So therefore, there's no question anymore. And that's what it means, that the Ribbono Shel Olam created every star. Every star has a place in the grand plan of the Ribbono Shel Olam of the universe. And no two stars are the same. They don't have the same elements. They don't have the same spectrum. Every star is different. We don't understand why all of them are necessary. But in God's plan, every single one has its unique qualities. And it is necessary for the perfection of the universe. And God counts each one, and He names each one. Each one has its specific qualities. That's the same way of Klal Yisrael. Every Jew is a star. Has qualities, abilities, capabilities, talents, a world to himself, like a star. And part of the grand plan of the Ribbono Shel Olam that the world was created for, and that ultimately the realization of that potential will bring the Geula. If that's the case, there's no more question. Why is Sefer Geula Sefer Shmos? Because the Geula is in the names of Klal Yisrael, is in the names of every Jew, for that matter, every human being, that has a part in the perfection, the bringing the perfection of this world, which is Geula, that is hinted to and that is contained within the names of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, Sefer Shmos and Sefer HaGeula, there couldn't be a closer connection between them, even though on the surface they don't seem to have any connection at all. Okay. Let's go on to the next thing. It says that Paro made Klal Yisrael serve Avodas Perech. Avodas Perech. Vayavidu Mitzrayim es Bnei Yisrael beforech. Perech is literally back-breaking work. It breaks you. Perech. Perech means to break into pieces. Prichot are crumbs or broken pieces. What exactly is work that breaks you? How much work does it have to be debilitating and break a person? The answer is that work can be very exhilarating, no matter how hard it may be, if it has a purpose. Purposeless work is debilitating no matter how hard it is. And therefore, Paro made them work avodas perech. There's a halacha that you're not allowed to make an Eved Ivri work avodas perech. Lo sirdenu beferech le'inecha. And that halacha has specific parameters. What aren't you allowed to make an Eved Ivri do? The Gemara says, the Rambam Paskins, what you can't make an Eved Ivri do is busy work. Work that has no limit and no purpose. Stam, keep busy. That kind of work is debilitating. That's called backbreaking work. There's a story that there was somebody in a Russian prison camp for 20 years. And every day he had to turn a handle that they told him was connected to a mill on the other side of the wall. And his job was to turn this mill and grind wheat into flour. So every day for 10 hours a day he would turn this thing. thinking that he was at least grinding wheat into flour. Finally, after 20 years, they let him out of the prison, and he said, "Before I leave, can I at least see the mill that I have been running all these 20 years?" And they laughed and laughed, and they took him to the other side of the wall, and they showed him there was nothing connected to the handle. For 20 years, he accomplished nothing. He said it was more, it was a greater sorrow to him to find out that he accomplished nothing in 20 years than the 20 years itself. That's called Avodas Perach. And that's why the Medrash says, Vayiven ore miskinos leparo. So miskinos can mean storehouses, but the word can also mean miskinos, the Medrash says. Miskain means something pitiful. They built pitiful cities. Paro had them built on sand. And when they were built, they fell over. They fell in. Because they were built on a foundation of sand. And they had to build them again. And they never accomplished anything. They built, it fell in, they built again. Because the purpose of Paro was not to get them to work. It was to get them to feel miyush, totally abandoned. And the work accomplished nothing. Work that accomplishes nothing is work that breaks a person. And Paro wanted to keep them broken people. And the proof to that is the following. In the end of the Sedra, Paro says, these people have too much time to think about freedom, so let's give them extra work to do. So I'm not giving you any more straw. You're going to have to gather straw, and you're going to have to produce the same quota of bricks that you produced when I gave you straw. So you're going to have to work doubly hard to produce the same quota. Now, Paro wasn't an idiot. But if I was Paro, I would have done something else. I would have given them straw, and I would tell them, you have to produce double the quota. Then I would gain double the amount of bricks. They would be working double hard, and everybody would gain. I would keep them working double hard, and I get double results. But why did Paro not give them straw, tell them they have to keep the same quota so he doesn't get anything extra, and they're working double hard? Why didn't Paro make them work double hard that he should benefit doubly? The answer is because if they would have produced a double quota, it would have given them satisfaction. And that kind of work doesn't break you. But working just double hard and producing nothing more, that's the kind of work that breaks you. That's Avodas Perach. It's interesting that the word Perach in Esbash, if you transpose the letters Aleph to Tav, Beis to Shin, and so on, so Perach becomes Vav Gimel Lamed. Now, Vav Gimel Lamed is not a word, but it's a number. If you add up Vav Gimel Lamed, what do you get? 39. It is a hint to the 39 Melachos of Shabbos. Now, there are different explanations. I'll tell you what my explanation is. The antithesis, if you take the opposite of Perach, which is Aleph to Tav, Beis to Shin, and so on, the opposite of Perach is Lamedtes. Lamedtes Melachos. Why? Because Avodas Perach is work that has no purpose. Purposeless work. And the Lamedtes Melachos was the work with the greatest purpose that could be. It built the Mishkan. So if you want to know what the antithesis of Perach is, it's Lamedtes Melachos of Shabbos. That is the most purposeful work that could be. Building a Mishkan and bringing the Shekhinah to the world. So that is Avodas Perach. Some people ask, therefore, that women's work seems to be Avodas Perach. Because you cook a meal, you don't frame it and put it, you know, for posterity in a museum. People eat it. It's gone. Right? You clean the house, and especially if you have little children, within minutes, right, everything that you did is back to the way it was. I remember when I was younger, my wife was younger, and we had a lot of little children in the house. I would leave the house in the morning, and it would look one way. And when I come back in the evening, it would look the same way. I looked at my wife and I said, what'd you do all day? And she said, you wouldn't believe this, but the house was like beautiful. Kids came home from school and turned it over to exactly the way it was in about 5 minutes. And many times I believed her. In any case, So that's the way. It's a lot of the work that women do, lechora, could be classified as avodas perach. So why isn't it? The answer is because the goal of the work is not to have a clean house. The goal is not to make a meal. The goal is through these things to create a home, to create an environment, to bring those children up to be functioning adults, and therefore the goal is not the clean house, it's not the meal, those are just means to reach an end. And the end, Tak, is a very important end, right? When you see that how you brought up a family, how you've created an environment, what the results are, that's not avodas perach at all. The means to get there may be things that don't last too long, but the goal is something that lasts eternally. So a person who understands that their job is not necessarily to make a clean house, to make a meal, to clean clothes, but all of that is the means to create a family, a home, a posterity, to bring up functioning Avdei Hashem, then that's very far from being avodas perach. Okay. Next. It says in the Pasuk, Vayigdal Hayeled, Basparo raised Moshe Rabbeinu, and he grew up. The next Pasuk says, Vayigdal Moshe. So the Ramban says, how many times did he grow up? Vayigdal Hayeled means that he grew up physically. Vayigdal Moshe means that he grew up emotionally matured. He became a mature person. What was the criteria that Moshe achieved that he was fit to be called a gadol, a mature person? So the Torah says, what was that which made him, that marked his maturity? Vayigdal Moshe, vayetze el echo, vayar besivlosam. He went out to his brothers and he saw their suffering. Rashi says, Nosan eino velibo lios meitzer aleihem. He put his eyes and his heart to suffer along with them. He empathized with them, not only sympathized for them. It was even more than empathy. That's called nose ba'olim chaveiro, mamish, to carry the load, whether it's a simcha or a tsar, a nisai, whatever it means, to feel the feelings of another person. Mamish felt with his eyes and his heart, and we'll discuss in 1 second why eyes and heart, what they felt. That is godless. That's being a godl. Why? So I think the reason is that Reb Shimon Shkop, in the Hakdama to his Sefer Shari Yosher, ask the following question. On the one hand, a Jew has to be concerned about himself. It is a Torah mandate to be concerned about yourself. And you come first. Self-concern is a must. For instance, it says that if you have enough money for tzedakah, but you need the tzedakah, and other people need tzedakah, you come first. Use your money for yourself. If you have a lost article that has to be found, or something is escaping from you, and something is escaping from your father, your mother, your Rebbe, at the same time, and you can save one of them, you come first. If you have a canteen of water, and can survive with that canteen, and if you share it with somebody else, then both of you will die, you take it. It's yours. Chayecha Kodman. You always come first. There is a legitimate mandate for self-concern. However, you don't only have to be concerned about yourself, you have to be concerned about other people too. So how do you balance and juggle self-concern and concern for others? You're required to do both. It seems to be a very difficult juggling act. Says Reb Shimon, it depends what your perspective on other people is. If you are from your toes to your head, that's you, and everybody else is somebody else, then you're talking to have a very difficult juggling act. Self-concern and concern for others. Very, very big conflict. But some people are bigger than that. And they know that their spouse is mamish part of them. And when they're concerned about their spouse, ishto kegufo, baal ke ishto, they're not concerned about somebody else. They're concerned about themselves, except themselves as two bodies. So that's self-concern. Concern for my spouse is self-concern. Some people are bigger than that. And they consider their children part of them. Bro karad avuon. A child is mamish an extension of the parent. So when I'm concerned about my children, I'm not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern. Except myself is a lot of bodies. Some people are bigger than that. And they recognize that their entire extended family, aunts, uncles, cousins, are all mamish atzmi ubisari. They're part of my flesh and blood. And therefore, I'm concerned about my extended family. I'm not concerned about somebody else. I'm concerned about myself, except myself now has a lot of bodies. And some people are bigger than that, and they recognize their whole neighborhood is part of them. Their whole city, their whole country, all of Klal Yisrael, the entire world. So, person who's really great encompasses everybody. Klal Yisrael, Aridim, Zebozeh. And therefore, it's all self-concern. There is no concern for myself and concern for others. Every concern I have is self-concern. It's just now a matter of logistics, which part of myself am I to be give priority to? Sometimes it's this part of myself, sometimes it's that part of myself. And if you think it's only semantics, because what difference does it make if I have a lot of parts of myself and I still have to make the decision which part comes first, or if it's me and them, I'll tell you something the Chiddush Arim says that makes it understandable is a very big difference. Yaakov Avinu, there were 12 rocks and they were fighting. Which one Yaakov's going to use as a pillow? That means that every rock in itself was big enough for his head. Okay? There wasn't little pebbles arguing. It was nice big stones. Okay? Because each one could have been the pillow. So what did the Rabban Shem do to make peace? He fused all the stones together into one gigantic rock. Now the rock is 12 times the size of Yaakov's head. So his head's only going to be on one portion of that stone. Why aren't they still fighting? Hey, I want him on my side. No, my side. Why'd they stop fighting? The answer is, as long as they were separate stones, it made a difference who Yaakov's head was going to be on. But once it was all one united stone, what difference does it make if it's on this side or that side? It's all part of me. So when I consider other people, others, then there's a big conflict between me and them. But when we're all one, and it's just a matter of which part of me has priority, it's much less of a conflict. That's godless. An Adam Gadol is a person who can mamish feel somebody else's tzaris, simchas, he's nosei ba'olim chaveiro, because he encompasses everybody. He's not just his own self from his toes to his head, but his self, his ani, is everybody. And I was thinking, Rabbi Shimon says, that's what the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Im ein ani li mili. If I don't worry about myself, then nobody's going to worry about me. But kishani li atzmi, when myself is only little me from my head to my toes, mo ani, that's not my ani. My ani has to encompass everyone. And then I have to be worried about myself. But myself as part of everyone else. And I think the word ani hints to that. What is the word ani? On one side is an aleph, is the individual. On the other side is the yod, is the tzibur, a minyan. Right? The minyan represents the kehila, the rabbin. So you have the yochid and the rabbin at either end of the word ani. What connects them to make that my essence? A nun. The nun represents chamishim sharei bina and chamishim sharei deya. There are 50 gates of wisdom and 50 gates of purity. That's what it means. Nosan einav velibo. Einav is intellectually. In order to feel somebody else's pain or their simcha or their needs, you have to know intellectually what they need, what they're going through. You have to know them intellectually. Einayim. But if you only know them intellectually and you have no heart, you won't feel. You'll just know it in a very abstract, objective, cold way. So you have to have a heart. You have to feel what they're feeling, not just know what they're feeling. But if you only have a heart and you feel for them, you may end up doing for them things that are really damaging because you feel for them. If you feel the needs of a drug addict, you feel for them, and you feed their addiction, you're hurting them. Which comes from the heart. So you have to have seichel to know that what's best for that person is to direct them to give up the habit, not to feed the habit. So you have to have seichel too. So you have to have both. You have to know intellectually what the needs are, and you have to have a heart to know how to fulfill them. But if you only have the heart, or you only have the eyes, it's not going to work. So you need the nun, the chamishim shari bina, and the chamishim shari tahara, to take the aleph and the yod, the individual and the tzibur, and make them into your ani, then it becomes your essence. That's what's called vayigdal noshim. Yes. So you had a question in the back? Somebody? Yeah. What? Okay. Let's go on. Next. It says, I think we may have done this in the Bereshis, but we'll repeat it again, because it says that Moshe's mother saw Vatireyu Kitov, she saw he was good, Vatitzbenehu Shlosha Yerachim, and because of that she hid him for 3 months. Now on the surface, it doesn't make any sense. She saw he was good, therefore she hid him for 3 months. That means that Moshe Rabbeinu's mother hid him. Why did she hide him? Because if she didn't hide him, the Mitzrim would come and drown him. Okay? What gave her the incentive to hide him and save his life? Because he was good. That means if he was a little brat, she probably would have delivered him into the hands of the Mitzrim and said, drown this little kid. That's what it sounds like. Vatireyu Kitov, she saw he was good, and therefore she hid him for 3 months. What is in the world does it have to do with that he was good have to do with the fact that she hid him for 3 months? She hid him for 3 months, save his life. What does that have to do with him being good? The answer is, I think, one of the answers, there could be many answers, that the word tov does not mean necessarily good. The word tov means something that is substantial and that can continue to exist, and the more it can exist, the more tov it is. Tov is that which is real in this world, that which is existent, whereas ra is the absence of existence. It doesn't really exist. There is no evil in this world. So tov is what really is substantial, exists, and the more it can exist, the more tov it is. Hodu Lashem ki tov, ki liolam chasdo. Since the Rabban Shom's chesed is forever, it's eternal, therefore, he's tov. It says that the word tov doesn't appear in the first luchos. It says, l'man yarichun yomecha, by kibud avoeim in the first luchos, but it doesn't say, l'man yitavloch. In the second luchos, it says yitavloch. Why is the word tov not in the first luchos? Because they were destroyed. And therefore they didn't last. So not tov. In Bereshis, it says, Vayar Elokim Kitov. The Rabban Shem created something, and then he saw it was good. So in first grade, you're allowed to understand that the following way. God said, let there be fish. And then he took a look, and he said, hey, not bad, looks like fish. Pretty good. Pat himself on the back, right? Looks pretty good, right? I think I did a nice job, right? I wanted to make fish, looks like fish. Lang's guns fight. That's absurd. The Rabban Shem knew exactly what he was creating. He didn't have to look at it to see if it was good, and he didn't have to say, Vayar Elokim, he saw it was good. He knew exactly what it was going to be. So what does it mean, Vayar Elokim Kitov? Says the Ramban, the Rabban Shem creates things by willing them into being. Vayomer Elokim. God, in our terminology, God wills things into being. But now they exist. What gives them the ability to continue to exist? God looks at them. And when he looks at them, Vayar Elokim, Vayomer Elokim brings it into existence. Vayar Elokim, looking at it, Ki Tov gives it the ability to continue to exist. Now let's go to Moshe Rabbeinu. I think the Rashbam says this. If you look at the Rashbam, after I tell you what I think he says, you may see it there. But I think this is what the Rashbam means. The Rashbam says like this. Moshe Rabbeinu was born 3 months premature. Normally, a 3 month premature baby doesn't survive. Hiding a baby from Paro and from his officers was probably punishable by death, because Paro said to kill all the Jewish males. If you tried to circumvent Paro's decree, you probably got either imprisoned or killed, probably killed. So therefore, if a Jewish baby was found being hidden in a home, they probably would kill all the people in the home for going against Paro's edict. That means that if you hid a Jewish baby, you were endangering the entire household. But you're allowed to do that. Why? Because endangering the household was only a suffix. Because it could be that they would hide the child well and they would never be caught. But if you didn't hide the child, he definitely would be killed. So it's worth putting the family into a threat, right, of destruction in order to save a baby from sure destruction. Okay? However, usually babies born that premature don't survive. So to put the entire family into danger, to hide a baby that probably was not viable, that wouldn't survive, wouldn't be allowed. Therefore it says, Vatireu Kitov, she saw he was viable, that he would survive. He wasn't like a regular premature baby, 3 months premature. He was going to survive. Therefore, she was allowed to hide him for 3 months, even though it put the family into danger, but that danger was only a doubtful danger, a possible danger, whereas the danger to the baby was for sure. If she didn't hide him, he would be drowned. So that's what it means. Vatireu Kitov, she saw he was viable. He had substance to him. He was going to survive, therefore she hid him for 3 months, and it was worth putting the family into danger for a baby that would survive. It wasn't worth putting the family into danger for a baby who's going to die anyway. That wasn't viable. That's, I think, what the Rashbam says. Okay, any questions on that? Go on, yeah.
But I thought that all the babies that were, like, taken by the stream, like, weren't, all stayed alive.
Were?
All stayed alive.
All alive afterwards?
Yeah.
Okay. Those are all Medrashim. We're talking about the Pshat in the Pasuk. Okay? The Medrash, Vatireo Kitovi, she saw that the Shechina was with him. She saw that there was light in the house. Right? And therefore she hid him knowing that the Rabban Shalom was going to make her successful. What's a Pshat in the Pasuk? There has to be a Pshat also, especially in Michlala with Rabbi Cooperman. There has to be a Pshat, not just Medrashim. Yeah? Yeah.
So maybe I'm just wondering, like, how you said the existence
wouldn't
continue then.
The idea being the following: on everything that it says Kitov, it only says it indirectly. Vayara Lokim Kitov doesn't say Vayara Lokim is Hadagim Kitov. The only thing it says directly Kitov is Or. Okay. Because the only thing that really is eternal is that original light that the Rabban Hashem created. Right? Everything else is only eternal indirectly, insofar that what it accomplishes here eventually will help to make Olam Haba. But in itself is not eternal, therefore it doesn't say Kitov by the things, and therefore on Yom Sheni it doesn't say Kitov, because what was created on Yom Sheni was Machlokis, which separation, which ultimately the world will unite under the Achdus of Hashem, there will be no separation, that's something that's not eternal at all together. That doesn't lead even to eternity. So all the things in the Bria were not really eternal, but they led to eternal things. So it only says Kitov indirectly. The Or of Shiva Shimei Bereshis is itself eternal, therefore it says Vayar Lokim Asa Or Kitov.
Is that like the same Or that Moshe had?
The Or of the Shechina, maybe. That's the Or HaGonus. That was the Or of Shiva Shimei Bereshis, which is going to be around by Olam Haba. Okay. Next, says that Moshe Rabbeinu was punished because they called him an Ish Mitzri, and seemingly he didn't protest, and therefore he wasn't buried in Eretz Israel. He let himself be called an Ish Mitzri, whereas Yosef proudly declared that he was from Eretz HaIvrim, ki gunov gunavti me'eretz HaIvrim. So he proudly admitted to his roots, and therefore his body was buried in Eretz Israel. The problem with that medrash is that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't there when they said Ish Mitzri. Pasuk says, Yisro said to his daughters, they said to him, Ish Mitzri hitzilonu miyad haroim. Right? An Egyptian man saved us. And Yisro said, Va'ayo, where is he? Call him, let him come and eat with us. That means he wasn't there. Otherwise, you'd have to call him, and Yisro wouldn't say, where is he? So how in the world did Chazal say that Yisro, that what's it called, Moshe let himself be called an Ish Mitzri, lo holdo bi'artzo. He didn't admit to his land, and he was called an Ish Mitzri, right? And he didn't correct them and say, Ish Ivri, when he wasn't even there. And the truth is that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't born in Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't his land. He was born in Mitzrayim. What do you want from him? Yosef was born in Eretz Yisrael. He was stolen away and brought to Mitzrayim. So of course he said, I'm not from this land. I come from a different land. But Moshe Rabbeinu was born in Mitzrayim. What do you expect from him? He wasn't born in Eretz Yisrael. I think the answer is the following. It's not so much whether he admitted, didn't admit, where he was born. Eretz Yisrael, what's the purpose of Eretz Yisrael? The purpose of Eretz Yisrael is the antithesis of what secular Zionism says the purpose of Eretz Yisrael is. Herzl created secular Zionism because, we will speak about this maybe as we get closer to Yom HaTzma'ut in the second class. What Zionism is, Yom HaTzma'ut, the Medina, Eretz Yisrael, Medinas Yisrael. But in any case, but now I just want to say a kernel of this. Secular Zionism was created because Herzl understood that anti-Semitism is a result of the fact that we are not normal. We are an abnormal people. We live in other people's lands. We speak their language. We use their economies. We don't have our own land, our own language, and that makes us parasites, abnormal people. And that's why the Goyim hate us. If we just have our own land, our own language, our own post office, and subsequent Zionist thinkers added, and our own criminals and our own perverts, then we will be normal, like all the nations of the world, and they won't hate us any more than they hate each other, which I don't know is any great anyway, because they hate each other too. But they really hate us more. So they wouldn't hate us more. We'd be like everybody else. And therefore the goal was to create a political entity where Jews could be normal, where we'd have our own state and be like all the nations of the world. That was the goal. Baruch Hashem, today we have our own country and our own language and our own post office and our own army and our own perverts and our own criminals, and the Goyim just love us. Right? They don't know what to do first for us. Right, it solved the problem. Obviously, it didn't solve the problem. Not only that, it made the problem worse. Because the old anti-Semitism was very unrefined, hating all those Jews with the long noses. But now, Goyim have a refined anti-Semitism. They don't hate Jews. They hate Israelis. Because Israelis are pushy. Israelis are occupiers. Israelis are apartheid. Whatever you want to... they hate Israel. They don't hate Jews. Who are these Israelis? All the Jews, from the Naturi Karta to the most secular Jew, with all those long noses. Same people. But now they have a refined way of saying it. We don't hate Jews, we just hate Israelis. Okay, so we created a new anti-Semitism. What is the purpose of Eretz Yisrael? The mamish, the opposite. Klal Yisrael have to lead a life of Kedusha. We are a mamleches kohanim, the goy kadosh. We are a nation of kohanim. Every one of us is a Kohen. A Kohen is God's representative to the Jewish people. We are God's representatives to the world. We don't do it by handing out God's calling card. I represent God. You need him? Call me. No. We do it by living a life of Kedusha. Kedusha does not mean sitting in a corner and saying Tillim all day. It's very nice to do that too. Kedusha means taking every aspect of life and living it in a way that's godly. Your economic life, your political life, your social life, your married life, you live it in a way that's not just moral, but mamish in a godly way. That when people see it, they see there must be a God because these people function in a godly way. Give you a quick example what that means, economically, right? There was a man, I think he's still alive, his name is Aaron Feuerstein. He lived outside of Boston. He had a textile mill that employed thousands of people. Gigantic textile mill. And it burned to the ground. And he had no more business. So morally, he could have told his workers, look, I don't have any work for you. Go please find other jobs. If when I rebuild my business, you want to come back and work, you have first chance on getting jobs by me. But I have no jobs now. But he didn't do that. He kept them all on the payroll, not to pay their salary, even though somebody told me he paid the salary also for a few months, even though he had no work for them. He kept them on the payroll so they shouldn't lose their pension benefits, they shouldn't lose their medical benefits. He told them, you have to go find other jobs to earn a living, but when I rebuild my factory, you're welcome to come and get jobs again. But I'm not going to take your names off my payroll in order that you don't lose your pensions, you don't lose your medical benefits. That's a godly way of dealing. And the whole world picked up on it, media-wise. It's a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. The man was a religious Jew. That's a Kiddush Hashem. That's what it means to live your economic life in a godly way. Morally, he would have been justified to lay them all off. Tell them, look, I don't have a job. Feel bad, but what can I do? This is a godly way, and that applies to every other aspect of life. So we need a place to create a society like that. Eretz Yisrael is an Eretz HaKodesh that has Hashgacha Pratis. We are a people that are Kodesh and have, what's it called, Hashgacha Pratis. So we fit each other perfectly. The purpose of Eretz Yisrael is that a Jew should be able to identify with the land, and it should be obvious that he is God's representative to the world. He's an Ish Kodesh. And therefore, Yosef HaTzadik said, I identify with Eretz HaIvrim. And therefore, he had a bond with that land. He was able to be buried there. But Moshe Rabbeinu should have looked different than every Mitzri. And the Benos Yisro should have picked up, this is not an Egyptian man. There's something about him that makes him different. But they saw him and they assumed he's a Mitzri. That in itself meant that Moshe Rabbeinu somehow at that point didn't represent totally what Eretz Yisrael represents. He was able to be mistaken for an Ish Mitzri. And if he was, then that bond with Eretz Yisrael was not complete. He couldn't be buried there. So it's not that he didn't say it. It's not that he didn't protest. It's just that he gave the impression of being an Ish Mitzri. That in itself, a Jew has to give the impression he's something different. He doesn't look like everybody else. There's something different about him. Everything that he does looks different. Yosef, it was obvious. Gunov gunavti mi'eretz ha'ivrim. By Moshe, it wasn't obvious, and therefore that intrinsic bond to Eretz Yisrael wasn't there. That's the idea. Okay, I finished about half of the things I wanted to speak about.